Our next story is all about the power of imagination. And I do mean power. Imagine if the Force really was with you. Imagine new toys controlled by brainwaves. It's this week's Science Out of the Box. There are two toy companies that plan to release mind-controlled toys by the end of the year. Both of them priced just about $100. Mattel's is called Mindflex, and Uncle Milton has a toy called the Force Trainer. It's Star Wars themed, and Yoda himself is telling you to
use the Force.
The idea is to levitate a ball by focusing your thoughts. We have that toy with us here in the studio, and also in the studio, Andrew Schroff, who works for Uncle Milton. You've been escorting this toy around the country, I guess. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jackie.
And also joining us is Jim Sullivan from San Francisco, and he's with NeuroSky, the company that developed the technology that makes both these toys work. Hi there, Jim Sullivan.
Hello, Jackie.
So, Andrew, this is a kind of simple-looking device. Well, it's a plastic tube, and with a ball inside it. So would you give me a demonstration, please?
Sure. We're going to turn on the base here.
All right. And what I'm wearing on my head is a headset with an arm on it that attaches to your forehead.
Level one.
And I'm going to look at the little ball and try to elevate it with nothing other than my powers of concentration, which are famed, of course. Okay, I'm about to try it. Woo! Did I do that?
Level.
You did. You just achieved the first level.
The little ball is actually rising. You're sure this isn't rigged and I'm really doing that?
I have no remote controls in my pockets. What you're actually controlling is a fan in the base unit that's blowing air to move the ball up and down the tube.
So, Jim Sullivan, have you actually seen these things?
I've seen it quite a few times. I've played with it. It's a lot of fun.
How is this actually working?
It's using medical technology that's been kind of reinvented to be applied to consumer and individual applications. It uses traditional EEG technology, which is electroencephalograph, that listens to your brainwaves. And brainwaves are very faint changes in electrical voltage emanating from your brain. So when you first put the headset on, it took a snapshot of what your attention level was then. And then what happens is from that point on, it looks for increasing attention levels to be able to incorporate that into the gameplay.
How does it know that I'm paying attention, especially if I'm talking?
That's a good question. And I think you noticed as you started talking, then the ball would start to sink back down again. We apply the signal to some algorithms that have been developed over thousands of hours of subject study and using, you know, people from everywhere, all walks of life, and looking for the commonalities when people are paying attention or when they're relaxed and, you know, calm. And we've created these algorithms that Uncle Milton uses in the Star Force Trainer. And essentially, we've been able to make it work on everyone right out of the box.
Now, this is a great deal of fun, but it's a bit of a parlor trick. Are there serious applications for this? I can think of Alzheimer's patients, people like that who might benefit?
That's one application we see, and we have a lot of people looking at things like that around ADD and Alzheimer's. Other applications include safety. If we can measure your attention level, how alert you are, then there's a number of commercial and even individual applications like the ability to put on a little Bluetooth headset as you're driving home at night, monitoring your brainwaves and looking for patterns that would occur prior to the onset of sleep. So if you start to get into that twilight zone before you start drifting to sleep, it'll give you a signal that, hey, you need to pull over. You're starting to drift off.
Jim Sullivan is with NeuroSky, and he joined us from member station KQED in San Francisco. And Andrew Schroff is with Uncle Milton, the company that developed the Force Trainer. May the Force be with you both.
Thanks very much, Jackie.
Thank you, Jackie.
Switch your targeting computer over to NPR.org, where you can watch me try out the Force Trainer.
Fans of the mystery series, the number one ladies detective agency, know two things about how its heroine looks. Precious Ramotswe is fat, or as she proudly puts it, a traditionally built African woman. And her smile is as warm as the African sun. Come this Sunday, American audiences can see Botswana's only lady detective in full. A 2-hour movie directed by the late Anthony Minghella kicks off a new HBO series based on the best-selling books. In this scene, Ma, or Madame Ramotswe, meets with her very first client.
I just need to speak with a detective.
About what?
About a problem.
A problem? A mystery?
Yes, exactly. A mystery.
Hallelujah. Please, just sit down here and we can enjoy a cup of bush tea in the shade.
Yalebocham.
I am Maramotswe, the detective.
It's a first leading role for singer and actress Jill Scott. Of course, Alexander McCall Smith wrote the books, and they've both joined us to talk about the new series. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For those who haven't read the books, how would you describe Precious Ramotswe?
Well, she's a woman of great intuitive ability. She's a very intelligent woman. She's kind. She's forgiving. She's just the sort of person that you'd like to sit down and have a cup of tea with. And she's fairly typical of many people whom you meet in that part of the world. I don't know whether... Jill, did you meet many Maramotswes when you were making the film?
I bumped into them all the time. In the grocery store, in the mall, at the movie theater. I kept meeting women who were sweet, just genuinely sweet and smart.
Well, let's listen to a few moments where Precious Ramotswe is describing to her admirer, J.L.B. Mataconi, the local mechanic who has a bit of a crush on her, why she's decided to become a detective.
Because I love my country, Botswana, and I love Africa, and I want to do good with the time God has given me. In every bar and market, behind every window, there are so many people who want to know the truth about some mystery in their lives, some mystery they cannot solve themselves.
It seems less about crime. She goes on to say it's more about solving people's problems.
I think she's, you know, absolutely inspiring in that way. Even if it's a small case, if there's someone who has a missing dog and it breaks their heart, you know, she's about it. If there's someone who feels that their husband isn't faithful to them or their wife or they have a child that's missing or whatever the situation may be, her view of justice isn't black and white. She wants the best for her country. And it doesn't necessarily have to do with, getting the police and the courts involved.
There's the young woman who has whose father disappeared when she was a baby, and mm-hmm. they thought he was dead, but he reappears.
Yeah.
We have a little clip where she's explaining her situation to Ma Ramotswe.
I am starting to suspect that this man may not actually be my daddy.
Not the daddy?
I think he may be an imposter who is only living with me because I have money and a good job.
This is a very bad story.
I'm sorry, Ma.
It will be him who will be sorry if I discover he is not the daddy.
Now, why is he in trouble if he's not the daddy?
Because that's just wrong. The fact that he's living off of this young woman, her name is Happy Papetsi. She's a good woman, she's a nice young lady, and he's living off of her. And that's just wrong, so she's going to fix it. She's going to mend it, she's going to recover the good in whatever situation she's in.
You know, there is a storyline in this first episode and also in the first novel that has to do with something quite dark. You know, and it's a real problem in Botswana and parts of southern Africa. It's in the midst of an otherwise very sunny, happy story. Witchcraft.
Well, yes. Firstly, I'd say that this problem of using body parts which are taken from people for the purposes of creating medicine, often strengthening medicine, known in that part of Africa as muti, still exists, but it's not very common, and it's very rare these days in a country like Botswana.
But in the sense that, in a way, this feels like a fairy tale, there is this, you know, even in fairy tales, there's a witch.
There's a background to this particular aspect of the first book, in that initially when I wrote the first draft of it, I didn't have that case in. And the book was concerned purely with very mild instances of wrongdoing or difficulties in people's lives. But I inserted that at the suggestion of the first publisher, who felt that the work didn't have sufficient grit about it. It wasn't strong enough. I rather regret doing it, actually, because it's certainly not in keeping with the overwhelming majority of the rest of the incidents in the series of books. I'm very used to people saying to me, oh, well, you paint a very optimistic, positive picture of the country. I think that, obviously, I'm a writer who works at that end of the spectrum.
But I really feel that the depiction has been fair. Being in Botswana for 4 months at a time or 5 months at a time, you really get an opportunity to spend time with all kinds of people, from people who live in small huts to people who live in big houses to anywhere in between. There is this certain nature about people in Botswana that is just warm. You know, it's just a different mentality. And I'm really appreciative that we get an opportunity to see this, because Africa, the continent, is not just what we see on the news. It's not, you know, I hate to say just, but it's not AIDS, and it's not just war and poverty. It's so much more. This is an abundant continent, and Botswana is an abundant place.
Thank you both very much for joining us. Thank you, Jill Scott.
Thank you.
And thank you, Alexander McCall-Smith.
Thank you very much.
And the series, The Number One Ladies Detective Agency, begins this Sunday on HBO.
The technology in the Force Trainer was also on display this week at the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco. The GDC, as it's known, is a massive event that attracts gamers from all over the world and the companies that want to sell them the next generation of Zeldas, Marios, and Grand Theft Autos. It's big stuff. In 2008, the industry took in $21.3 billion in U.S. sales, according to the research group NPD. That's about what Americans spent last year on DVD rentals and sales. Ricardo Torres is the editor-in-chief of GameSpot, a website dedicated to games and gamers, and he covered the Game Developers Conference all week, and he joins us now from San Francisco. Hello, Ricardo Torres.
Hello, Jackie.
There was one big bombshell announcement at the conference. Let's listen to Steve Perlman, the CEO of a startup company called OnLive.
This is an opportunity to really revolutionize the way we think about games, the way that publishers develop games, and the way that consumers use games.
Well, that's pretty lofty language, even for a game developer. What is this new mystery device that was being rolled out, Ricardo Torres?
It's going to take a second to wrap your head around it. Traditionally, people have thought about video games as something that you need to play on a dedicated console, right? Like your Xbox 360, your PlayStation 3, or your Wii. And each one of those boxes has software that is specific to them. So what OnLive is essentially almost like a universal box. It's a games-on-demand service.
So you just click and play, and it comes into your television set or your PC?
Yeah, isn't that crazy? And, you know, you can rent or buy it. You're not going to have the clutter of a ton of consoles in your living room or a ton of software, because everything's done digitally. And it definitely has the potential to completely change the natural order of things.
It sounds really good. Is there any kind of drawback that you can think of?
You know, I think the biggest challenge, and I think people get this, even, you know, when you have your internet, you have varying speeds. Mm-hmm. And depending on the type of connection you have, if a lot of people are on that connection, it slows down. Well, this whole service is dependent on having a very fast internet connection. I think that the real challenge for them is going to be, if this service really does become popular and everybody's hitting that service at the same time, are they going to be able to handle the load and to really give the performance that people are expecting?
The Game Developers Conference is also home to a big awards ceremony. It wouldn't be a conference if there wasn't one. Let's listen into how it went this year.
And the award for Best Downloadable Game goes to World of Goo.
I don't think I've seen World of Goo. It sounds pretty repulsive. I guess there's an interesting story behind that game.
Well, it's a cute game, actually. It's probably the cutest goo you're ever going to see. But essentially, it's a puzzle game. And it's very simple. You just have to get these little blobs of goo into a vacuum. It was developed by a game developer called 2D Boy, which is essentially three guys. Mm-hmm. And Nintendo approached them and asked if they would adapt that for the Wii. They know what's good. And for it to get their stamp of approval and their endorsement was a really good thing for the indie game scene in general, because in the absence of big budgets and a ton of resources, everybody's just being really resourceful and kind of MacGyvering these really cool new things that a bigger publisher probably wouldn't think to try.
Well, are there a lot of MacGyvers out there this year? Are small independents taking on some of the big names?
Absolutely. I think you want to think of the games industry like the movie industry. The game buying public is always going to have that expectation for the blockbuster, right? Everybody's going to want their big summer movie. And that's kind of the entertainment that the big three can provide. Those big games cost money and take a ton of time to create. In the interim, they're looking for new kinds of content. And more we're starting to see the big developers reaching out to the indie game scene.
Ricardo Torres is editor-in-chief of the gamers website, GameSpot.com, and he joined me from San Francisco, where the Game Developers Conference just wrapped up. Thanks a lot. It's been fun having you.
Absolutely. Thanks very much.
On average, Americans see over an hour of commercials every day. That fact comes courtesy of a new study out today by the Nielsen Company. They're the people also responsible for television ratings. But as NPR's Neda Ulaby reports, their findings go far beyond your TV.
The study covered everything with a screen: television, email, video games, GPS, and texting. To figure out who uses what, when, where, and on what device, researchers actually walked behind 450 people for 2 days, from after they woke up to before they went to bed. Every 10 seconds, they recorded updates on their subjects' media consumption.
It is logistically very demanding. I often refer to it not as research, but as logistical masochism.
Mike Bloxam of Ball State University helped lead the project. His team answered questions about media consumption that have bugged ad executives since the days of the man called the father of modern advertising.
John Wanamaker said that, 50% of my advertising dollars is wasted, but I don't know which half.
That's advertising consultant Sherry Ann Brill.
And then there's been numbers floating around the industry saying that consumers are exposed to, on average, 500 ads a day. And a lot of those numbers are pretty much fictional, to use the most polite word.
Brill says this study gives definitive data to advertisers used to hearsay and unreliable self-reporting. For example, it shows that most consumers average about 8.5 hours daily in front of a screen. Makes sense when you think about computer usage at work.
Conventional wisdom is very much that younger people spend more time with media, spend more time with screens. Interestingly, we found the group that spent most time with media was actually what we think of really as the younger boomers.
Bloxam says 45 to 54-year-olds spend an hour a day more on average than old people or teenagers. Traditional TV is by far the most popular screen, but what we watch and how we watch is changing.
Probable aortic injury.
I need a 28.
Try the hallway.
Whoa.
Take a show like ER. At its peak in 1996, it drew over 30 million viewers, says James McQuivey. He analyzes media at Forrester Research.
Nowadays, a show is considered a hit if it gets 6, 7, 8 million households. It's a smash hit if it's in the teens.
The days of mass viewership are essentially gone. And this $3.5 million study is part of a desperate effort by numerous industries to figure out how to get ads on the screens we face for much of our waking lives.
Everyone's nervous because just around the corner they see everyone going off a cliff.
TV has never been more popular, says McQuivey, but it's changing in ways that not everyone gets and that no one can control. Neda Ulaby, NPR News.